The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards with another edition of the Armchair Traveler from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. And over the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from the National Geographic Traveler, as well as the Washington Post. Now, before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles we're going to be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. And as we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, we start with writer Lee Kabosh sharing his wild and tame experience in Tasmania. His article, found in the October-November 2019 issue of the National Geographic Traveler. And as the editors note, Tasmania's natural richness comes in many forms. Pristine landscapes in all shades of green, tranquil waterways, and curious wildlife that thrives in this unique environment. However you approach its unspoiled beauty, adventure awaits in Australia's island state. It feels like I've fallen headfirst into the realms of a children's storybook. A wisdom of wombats is mowing the grass around us. Mobs of Tasmanian pademelon, small kangaroo-like creatures leap past, and a kookaburra sings from an old gum tree. Blue skies arch above us as we rest on the grassy edge of sea cliffs on the lookout for humpback whales. It is surely hell on earth, says my guide, Di Hollister, paraphrasing a 19th century description of Tasmania. The swans are black when they should be white, and devils cry out in the woods at night. Just awful, I reply with a smile. We're on Maria Island, which lies in the bright blue Tasman Sea, a 30-minute ferry ride from Tryobana on the east coast of Tasmania. European explorers first set eyes on the island in 1642. Settlers arrived in the late 18th century, eking out a living as whalers and sealers, while establishing small holdings, prisons, and penal colonies. Various industries came and went over the following century. Wheat and sheep farmers, Chinese abalone fishermen, and Italian silk merchant with aspirations as a hotelier, and a cement works, its old silos still sitting at the end of the pier like giant exclamation marks. Every venture was unsuccessful and short-lived, and nature now reigns supreme in this southern wilderness. Today, Maria Island is a national park without a permanent population, and visitor numbers are restricted to just a few ferry loads of sightseers per day in the summer and a handful of outdoorsy types who come year-round to explore its beaches and bush trails with award-winning family-run Maria Island Walks. I've arrived just after the summer crowds have cleared and a few weeks before the chill of winter sets in. It feels like we have the island to ourselves, just me, Di, and our walking guide, Georgie Current. I'm bowled over by the natural beauty that surrounds us. Glorious beaches, fragrant forests of eucalyptus, ruffled cliffs, tranquil reservoirs, and bountiful wildlife. On the crossing from Tryobana, I eyed flat, shiny seals bobbing in the bay and enormous sea eagles circling overhead. Within 5 minutes of stepping off the ferry, I cooed over a mother and baby wombat, both entirely unperturbed by my presence. I've since seen dozens of the furry cannonballs, as well as kangaroos, wallabies, possums, and a colorful cast of pink robins, yellow-throated honey-eaters, and Cape Barren geese with pearl-gray bodies and sherbet-green beaks. As the daylight begins to fade, I'm blessed with a crisp, bright evening for my first night on Maria Island. The moon appears seemingly upside down as I've come from the northern hemisphere, and is so luminous we don't need our flashlights to wander across the fields. Di points out constellations as we go, the Southern Cross, Alpha Centauri, and Orion's Sword, which points upward at this end of the earth. The next morning, as we head to Reedle Beach, a streak of diamond-white sands and azure seas, and the first beach I've seen in years without even the tiniest scrap of plastic on it. What we spot instead are the clear paw prints of Tasmanian devils, an endangered species released onto the island in the 1970s and now thriving free from predators, car accidents, and disease. If I see nothing else of Tasmania, my time in this Edenic Isle alone will have been enough. Complete immersion. I'm told that Maria Island is Tasmania in microcosm, and, if that's the case, then Di is Tasmania personified. A veritable frontiers woman at 72 years old, her eyes are the color of the water at Riedel Beach, and just 6 months after a double knee replacement, she's outpaced me every step of the way on our hikes around Maria. She grows her own vegetables, brews her own ginger beer, promotes environmental causes, and has an in-depth knowledge of every bud, bloom, bird, and beast we passed. She drives like a pro, too, dodging a masked white owl in the middle of the road on the long drive through the night to our next stop in Derby, a former tin mining town in the northeast of Tasmania. It's home to the Blue Derby Pods Ride, where I fuel up on a feast of local sourdough and butter, pumpkin and hummus, and salad ahead of a beginner's lesson in mountain biking. Set up in 2017 by 20-something Tassie Steve and Tara Howell, Blue Derby Pods Ride combines three-day mountain biking tours with spectacular food and wine, plus accommodation in one of four wooden pods which rise out of the mossy forest like a newly germinated seed. Come bedtime, I feel like an elf living deep in the heart of the forest. 4 years ago, this clever endeavor never would have worked, as there was virtually no reason for travelers to visit this corner of the island. But in 2015, the Blue Derby, a network of nearly 50 miles of world-class mountain bike trails, opened and was immediately lauded as the pinnacle of mountain biking in Australia. Soon after, the Enduro World Series headed here, and Derby was firmly on the map. The biking tours are flexible and can accommodate anyone from seasoned riders to novices like me. We want you to ride the way you'd go out and ride with friends, Steve tells me, as we whirl downhill through mounds of fishbone ferns, past tangles of myrtle, and under the thick branches of microcarpa trees. Botanically speaking, it's a dream. Exercise-wise, however, my backside hurts, and the combination of fresh air, adrenaline, and a new challenge means I retire to my pod exhausted, yet contented in a way that only a complete immersion in nature can achieve. All aboard the Ark. Nature, both wild and tame, comes thick and fast in Tasmania. Flocks of green rosellas, a parrot native for the state, swoop overhead on the drive out of Derby, through Scottsdale with its rolling green hills and fields of apricots, cherries, and poppies. An overnight stay at Karawang Lakes, a luxury lodge and fly fishing retreat tucked away in Tasmania's remote eastern highlands, brings a bevy of black swans, hundreds of Bambi-like fallow deer, and Tasmanian devils, their husky screams like something from a Wes Craven film. From Karawang, we head west via the beautifully preserved towns of Launceston, Bothwell, and Hamilton into Mount Field National Park, one of 19 protected parklands in Tasmania. It's another vision of pastoral beauty, all fern walks, waterfalls, and glassy salmon ponds. There are paint charts of greens made by the willows and swamp gums, the latter the tallest flowering plant in the world. It's here that Liam and Fiona Weaver run Tassie-bound adventure tours, leading small groups of kayakers on Paddle with the Platypus trips through the park's sylvan waterways. I reckon there are more platypus on these 3 miles of river than anywhere else in Australia, says Liam, as Di and I pull on our life jackets. And sure enough, as we glide down the tranquil River Derrent, we spot more platypus than humans, their little backs rising and falling in the water like tiny Loch Ness monsters. But my closest encounter with Tasmania's wildlife comes at the Bonorong Wildlife Sanctuary, where I begin to suspect the staff are inventing curiously named animals to make fun of me. Bitang, Quokka, Echidna, all fictional, surely? Well, we're the Noah's Ark of Australian wildlife, founder Greg Irons tells me, as I pet Millie the baby wombat. I learned that most of the animals taken in here have been orphaned or injured. We're the last stand for so many special species, prehistoric species, species you won't find anywhere else in the world, species we still know very little about, says Steve, or Greg, rather. Well, there are creatures such as eastern quolls, a cat-sized marsupial now extinct on the mainland, the Tasmanian tree frog, and, of course, the Tasmanian devil, whose population has fallen by 90% since the late 1990s due to a facial tumor disease. Greg's aim is to rehabilitate and restore populations and get as many animals back into the wild as he can. In the meantime, visitors to the sanctuary are allowed to interact with many of the animals in ways that won't stress or upset them. I hand-feed kangaroos, watch Randall with the echidna slurp-up ant mush with his long tongue, and offer eucalyptus leaves to a rather bored-looking koala. If Tasmania is hell, like Di says, then I plan on being very, very bad indeed. And in the first part of the article, we also learn about some more natural, final part of the article, learn more about the natural landscapes associated with Tasmania. These are some brief descriptions, all afloat, founded by Robert Pennicott, the first person to circumnavigate Australia in a rubber dinghy. Pennicott Wilderness Journeys offers a full-throttle adventure around the Tasmanian coast. Wrap up warm and take in sea calves, cliffside waterfalls, walls of Jurassic dolerite, and freestanding sea stacks, all while passing Australian fur seals and flocks of giant albatross. Be sure to look south. The next land mass, rather, is Antarctica. And you can learn more about them, by the way, online at pennicottjourneys.com.au. That's P-E-N-N-I-C-O-T-T, pennicottjourneys.com.au. Then we have wine and wombats at the conservation-led Bangor Vineyard Shed, rather. A short drive from the state capital of Hobart, visitors can drop by for a twilight bus and walking tour to spot wombats, one of Tasmania's most charismatic critters. After learning about the area's unique ecosystem, guests will return to the restaurant for dinner, washed down, of course, with glasses of refreshing Tasmanian Chardonnay and mid-bodied Pinot Noir. And you can check it out online at bangorshed.com.au, B-A-N-G-O-R, bangorshed.com.au. Then we have penguin parades. This far south, it's no surprise that penguins can be seen on Tasmanian shores. The flightless birds make landfall on the northwest coast where Bacino Penguin Tours runs evening excursions to a private rookery. Watch as the creatures emerge from the sea and make their way uphill to the nest. Penguin numbers vary according to the season, with September to March being the best time to see them. And you can check it all out at bicinopenguintours.com.au. B-I-C-H-E-N-O, bicinopenguintours.com.au. And finally, gone fishing. Tasmania's first trout were introduced in 1864, having been delivered from Britain on the Norfolk ship. Today's bronze beauties are descended from the original batch and are considered to be the purest of the species in the world. Stay at Karawang Lakes and don your waders with instructor Roger for a meditative session casting, catching, and releasing fish while white-bellied sea eagles soar above. Karawanglakes.com.au has more information for you. That's C-U-R-R-A-W-O-N-G, Karawanglakes.com.au. And Lee Kabosh offers some essential tips if you're thinking about traveling to Tasmania. Here they are. Getting there and around, Tasmania is easily accessible from the mainland with major Australian airlines flying direct to both Hobart and Launceston from main Australian hubs. Tasmania is also a great self-drive destination. And let's see, when to go? The warmest months are December through February, around 75 degrees Fahrenheit then. Spring is bright but windy, and fall offers crisp, sunny days with fewer crowds. Short winters, June through August, can see temperatures between 37 degrees and 52 degrees Fahrenheit. And then, of course, they make a suggestion. How do you do all this? Well, Qantas Vacations offers the 8-day Wild Tasmania Immersion Tour with activities including kayaking, hiking, and a trip to Maria Island. And it starts at $1,849 per person, excluding flights. Airfares are available upon request at QantasVacations.com. So there you go. Wow, what a trip that would be, huh? Well, from the island state of Tasmania, we're going to head north to the Arctic. The topic of a Why It Matters essay, this one written by Jennifer Schnurr, and appearing in the October-November 2019 issue of National Geographic Traveler. Now, in her article, Jenna focuses on how to protect a fragile place and the people who call it home. Cheryl Rosa will never forget the light and cold that greeted her on her first trip to Arctic Alaska. It was extremely windy and extremely flat and extremely white, she says, of landing in Yukikiavik, then called Barrow, which sits at the edge of the Beaufort Sea. Now the deputy director of the U.S. Arctic Research Commission, Rosa first visited the region in 2000 to do field work for her thesis. The landscape grabbed the Massachusetts native whole. Travel to the Arctic leaves an indelible impression on the visitor. Its sheer immensity and the fragility of its environment are two things that really blow people away, Rosa says. The Arctic is ground zero for climate change, and what happens in the Arctic has an astonishing trickle-down or perhaps flood-down effect on the rest of the planet. The region's surface air temperatures have warmed at two times the rate of the rest of the globe. Sea ice is disappearing rapidly. Permafrost is melting. And a number of caribou that graze land have declined by almost half, according to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration Arctic Program. Scientists have made it clear that humans are driving climate change, but if we act quickly and globally, we might be able to reverse some of the damage. The Arctic is not just an idea we read about and in the newspaper. It's land. It's sea. It has been home to humans for thousands of years. And for those who can make the trip, there's no better way to connect with the region than to meet some of its people and stand on the vast tundra or look out on the Arctic Ocean. I started visiting Alaska from my then home, New York City, 18 years ago. The trips grew longer and longer, and I finally moved to Anchorage in 2013. The Arctic began to feel less remote, less of an idea than a real place. I'd meet Arctic scientists while out at breweries, and at my local yarn store, I'd make friends with people who had grown up in the Arctic. Talk of the region swirled around me. The Arctic stopped being lines on a globe and photos and books and became a place I wanted to explore, to write about, to protect. The Arctic is both part of the state I now call home and a region that connects the U.S. to other nations, a place we all should safeguard together. Ice doesn't obey borders when it melts into the sea, causing ocean levels to rise. My first trip to the Arctic, a mid-July day trip with a group up to Coldfoot in the Brooks Range, only fed my growing fascination with the region. How could one ever spend enough time there, an area that crosses 8 countries and 5.5 million square miles, about the size of 631 New Jerseys or 34 Californias? How could I return home ever thinking, well, I've seen enough, or I've met enough local people, or I just can't look at another walrus? Ridiculous thoughts all. Brooklyn-based artist Zariah Foreman, who is the art curator for the new polar ship National Geographic Endurance, is a case study in the ways travel to the Arctic can transform a life. Foreman's mother, a photographer, first took Foreman to Greenland in 2007. Until that trip, Foreman knew of climate change as this distant subject, she says, but it opened her eyes to issues including the ways locals had to adapt their lifestyles because of the changes in their environment. Now she travels to the Arctic regions for at least a month at a time, photographing and sketching areas that are intriguing compositionally and evoke strong emotions in order to make large-scale pastels as realistic as possible to give the viewers the same feeling. There are so many kinds of ice, she says. The Arctic is an endless source of inspiration. Travel to the Arctic changed John Gadeck's life even before it began. I first came across Gadeck on Instagram, easily the most accessible way to tour Arctic. Gadeck is manager of Ian Cook Lake Wilderness Lodge, 225 miles north of Fairbanks and 60 miles above the Arctic Circle. In the Brooks Range, his parents built the lodge in 1974. It is still home for half of each year. The nearest neighbors are 50 miles away in Bates. Arctic travel grips his guests as soon as they board the plane to get there. The big transformation is the two-hour flight in there, he says. Within 20 minutes of leaving Fairbanks, they don't see anything. It's so remote. Even the villages that punctuate the landscape disappear from sight within seconds. The other day, I added a new item to the list of places I want to experience in the Arctic, a list which includes visiting Ellesmere Island in Canada, watching polar bears in Greenland and talking to the people of Nunavut about what it takes to collect Kinuit wool from muskox. The new place on my list is called Anatukavuk in Pass, and it's in the Central Brooks Range. I had called the Simon Panik Memorial Museum in this Nunamiut Inupiat village to interview Louisa Riley, president of the museum, and Vicky Monahan, the curator. When travelers come through the region, or the village rather, Monahan provides a quick immersion tour into the life and history of her people, how the U.S. government forced them to give up their nomadic ways. She sees the impact of climate change on the land and the Inupiat lifestyle. The summers are shorter and the winters are warmer, making it harder to harvest the meat, berries, and other plants they depend on for their subsistence. I paint a picture where they get an understanding of what we've been through and what we're doing today, Monahan tells me. We don't have much choice, Riley said. You have to adapt. We're real resilient. Traveling to any part of the Arctic takes time, money, and planning. Here are some good ways to be a good steward of the Arctic before, during, and after your trip. One, go with tour groups that are respectful of Arctic residents and their culture, says U.S. Arctic Research Commission's Cheryl Rosa. Too many people can overwhelm small villages. Finding tour groups that work with local communities is important. Next, take nothing but photos, unless you buy art or other souvenirs from the local people. And continuing on the list, learn whose land you're touring and ask permission before taking photos of people or their homes. And then, when you get home, tell your friends and family about your trip and help them understand what issues are in the balance, says Rosa. I do believe most visitors leave with a better understanding of why the Arctic is important and how high the stakes are. Well, writer Jenna Schnuer lives in Anchorage, Alaska. She is a freelance writer and has produced articles for the Smithsonian, New York Times, and Edible Alaska, among other publications. Well, writer Kate Silva is a self-confessed introvert. Her article, Traveling While Introverted, One Semi-Social Writer's Guide, is found in the October 10, 2019 issue of the Washington Post. Are you ready for this one? How is the lack of talking, a good friend asked in an email. I was 8 days into a 10-day solo trip in Portland, Oregon, and the lack of talking was, in a word, refreshing. Disclosure, there was some talking. I'd chat with neighbors at the house where I was staying, to cashiers at stores, and to the occasional passersby. In between, I was loving every minute of what I've come to call my semi-social introverted adventure. If you're a sister or a brother in introversion, then you already know we live in an extroverted world and are expected to conform to the societal expectations of while being social and gasp, making small talk while doing it. Well, despite the energy suckage that comes from the territory, as opposed to extroverts who on the opposite side of the continuum tend to feel energized through interacting with people. Well, travel can sometimes seem at odds with introversion, whether it's the hustle and bustle of crowded landmarks in an unfamiliar city, the constant companionship of traveling partners, or the fact that we've been told time and again by travel writers that travel's all about getting out of your comfort zone, pushing boundaries, giving a life larger, or living, rather, a life larger than your own. On this trip, after fighting the usual temptation of travel to do anything and everything Portlandia, a farm brunch here, a beer fest there, a solo trip to Kambuka Speakeasy, I decided to gratify my inner introvert, seeking out experiences that would replenish rather than deplete me. By the time the 10 days were up, I felt about as recharged as I'd ever been. If you're headed out on your own introverted adventure, here are some ideas for how to make the most of a city on your own semi-social terms. Okay, introverts, you ready for this? First, work your workout into the scene. Some of my most memorable travel moments, whether on group trips, couples excursions, or traveling solo, have been my solo jogs. I recall running through the shady parks in Rome, past brightly colored homes on the west coast of Wales, and to serene gardens of the Grotto, a Catholic shrine in Portland. A run or a walk, if that's more your speed, allows for downtime while also exploring the city on your terms, your own terms, and at your own pace. Plus, it helps justify the inevitable extra calories that come with travel. Well, seek out sit-down restaurant alternatives. Sit at the bar or bring a book is the advice often offered to traveling introverts and solo adventurers. Thanks, but no thanks. I'd still rather not have my fumbling small talk skills tested unless it's dire. Well, in Portland, in particular, I found food trucks to be about the best option for table of one dining. There, pods of food trucks offer shady outdoor eating options or seating, and a pan-global hodgepodge of options, including Myanmar's Mediterranean, French, Mexican barbecue, and more. Some pods even have dedicated bar trucks slinging beer and wine. In other cities, it's easy to find fast casual options with local flair, like food halls, order at the counter joints, carry out, or even delivery. Now, you can book a tour as another suggestion. For a fast context to learn about a city, you can't beat a walking tour. And for this shy introvert, the bigger the tour group size, the better, so as to avoid awkward introductions and anxiety-inducing icebreakers. For example, name your favorite breakfast food and your favorite president. Free walking tours are especially appealing, and on my trip, I learned a lot from the Secrets of Portlandia tour. If the free tour is good, you can stick around and tip at the end. If it doesn't hold your interest, you can slip away early and go about your day. No money lost. Well, seek out readings, performances, and intriguing places. Heather's, the musical, was sold out during my Portland trip, but I had no problem finding other passive entertainment. One night, I went to an author reading at the massive bookstore Powell's, where I learned about a new podcast that became my jogging companion for the week. The next, I attended Paranormal Pub Night at the Kennedy School, a once-abandoned elementary school that's now home to a number of restaurants, bars, and a hotel. I sat toward the back of the theater, cold IPA in hand, and listened to a psychic conduct eerie readings for some of the attendees. 2 days in a row, I went to Hollywood Theater, an ornate, nearly century-old movie house, and watched weird horror movies that wouldn't have appealed to many others in my life. All these events gave me plenty to think about for days, and I felt connected to the people and pulse of the city, even though I didn't utter a word. Embrace the outdoors is the next suggestion. Nature can be a balm for introverts. Beaches, lakes, forests, mountains, they're the perfect backdrop for quiet contemplation or deep conversations. There, it's easy to feel a part of something larger and draw energy from the serene beauty all around, whether you're gazing at it from a park bench or hiking, biking, or paddling through. Say cheese. Extroverts, who often have a knack for starting conversation with anyone, anytime, anywhere, may laugh at the clunky small talk skills of introverts, but the struggle is real. I recently learned that the secret to starting a less awkward conversation with a stranger revolves around selfies. I observed it time and again on my solo trip. Someone was posing for their own photo when a nice stranger noticed and asked if they could help. Each time, it led to a pleasant chat about the surroundings, sometimes evolving into a deeper conversation. If you're feeling lonely or just starting to wonder whether what your voice sounds like, this is a natural end. All the introverts I know have the power to rise to the occasion and be as outgoing and adventurous as they need to be on a given moment. In most of my travels, rather, that's what I've done. But I've also found it's a deep sense of satisfaction and that company's going with my own flow. Lack of talking and all. There you go, introverts. And believe it or not, that's going to bring us to the end of today's Armchair Traveler. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, the content of our program intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Broadcast is readily available as a podcast for the broadcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Questions and comments can be directed to 919-832-5138. Bye-bye.